Supreme Court of the United States, Wickard versus Filburn, 1942. Mr. Justice Jackson delivered the opinion of the court. The appellee filed his complaint against the Secretary of Agriculture of the United States, three members of the County Agricultural Conservation Committee for Montgomery County, Ohio, and a member of the State Agricultural Conservation Committee for Ohio. He sought to enjoin enforcement against himself of the marketing penalty imposed by the amendment of May 26, 1941, to the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, upon that part of his 1941 wheat crop which was available for marketing in excess of the marketing quota established for his farm. He also sought a declaratory judgment that the wheat marketing quota provisions of the Act, as amended and applicable to him, were unconstitutional because not sustainable under the Commerce Clause or consistent with the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. The Secretary moved to dismiss the action against him for improper venue, but later waived his objection and filed an answer. The other appellants moved to dismiss on the ground that they had no power or authority to enforce the wheat marketing quota provisions of the Act, and after their motion was denied, they answered, reserving exceptions to the ruling on their motion to dismiss. The case was submitted for decision on the pleadings and upon a stipulation of facts. The appellee for many years past has owned and operated a small farm in Montgomery County, Ohio, maintaining a herd of dairy cattle, selling milk, raising poultry, and selling poultry and eggs. It has been his practice to raise a small acreage of winter wheat, sown in the fall and harvested in the following July, to sell a portion of the crop, to feed part to poultry and livestock on the farm, some of which is sold, to use some in making flour for home consumption, and to keep the rest for the following seeding. The intended disposition of the crop here involved has not been expressly stated. In July of 1940, pursuant to the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, as then amended, there were established for the appellee's 1941 crop a wheat acreage allotment of 11.1 acres and a normal yield of 20.1 bushels of wheat an acre. He was given notice of such allotment in July of 1940 before the fall planting of his 1941 crop of wheat, and again in July of 1941 before it was harvested. He sowed, however, 23 acres and harvested from his 11.9 acres of excess acreage 239 bushels, which under the terms of the Act as amended on May 26, 1941, constituted farm marketing excess, subject to a penalty of 49 cents a bushel or $117.11 in all. The appellee has not paid the penalty, and he has not postponed or avoided it by storing the excess under the regulations of the Secretary of Agriculture or by delivering it up to the Secretary. The committee therefore refused him a marketing card, which was under the terms of regulations promulgated by the Secretary, necessary to protect a buyer from liability to the penalty and upon its protecting lien. The general scheme of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, as related to wheat, is to control the volume moving in interstate and foreign commerce in order to avoid surpluses and shortages and the consequent abnormally low or high wheat prices and obstructions to commerce. Within prescribed limits and by prescribed standards, the Secretary of Agriculture is directed to ascertain and proclaim each year a national acreage allotment for the next crop of wheat, which is then apportioned to the states and their counties, and is eventually broken up into allotments for individual farms. Loans and payments to wheat farmers are authorized in stated circumstances. The Act further provides that whenever it appears that the total supply of wheat as of the beginning of any marketing year beginning July 1 will exceed a normal year's domestic consumption and export by more than 35%, the Secretary shall so proclaim not later than May 15th prior to the beginning of such marketing year, and that during the marketing year a compulsory national marketing quota shall be in effect with respect to the marketing of wheat. Between the issuance of the proclamation and June 10th, the Secretary must, however, conduct a referendum of farmers who will be subject to the quota to determine whether they oppose it or favor it, and if more than one-third of the farmers voting in the referendum do oppose, the Secretary must, prior to the effective date of the quota, by proclamation, suspend its operation. On May 19, 1941, the Secretary of Agriculture made a radio address to the wheat farmers of the United States in which he advocated approval of the quotas and called attention to the pendency of the amendment of May 26, 1941, which had at the time been sent by Congress to the White House, and pointed out its provision for an increase in the loans on wheat to 85% of parity. He made no mention of the fact that it also increased the penalty from 15 cents a bushel to one-half of the parity loan rate of about 98 cents, but stated that, because of the uncertain world situation, we deliberately planted several million extra acres of wheat. Farmers should not be penalized because they have provided insurance against shortages of food. Pursuant to the Act, the referendum of wheat growers was held on May 31, 1941. According to the required published statement of the Secretary of Agriculture, 81% of those voting favored the marketing quota, with 19% opposed. The court below held, with one judge dissenting, that the speech of the Secretary invalidated the referendum and that the amendment of May 26, 1941, insofar as it increased the penalty for the farm marketing excess over the 15 cents per bushel prevailing at the time of planting, and subjected the entire crop to a lien for the payment thereof, should not be applied to the appellee because, as so applied, it was retroactive and in violation of the Fifth Amendment, and, alternatively, because the equities of the case so required. Its judgment permanently enjoined appellants from collecting a marketing penalty of more than 15 cents a bushel on the farm marketing excess of appellee's 1941 wheat crop, from subjecting appellee's entire 1941 crop to a lien for the payment of the penalty, and from collecting a 15 cent penalty except in accordance with the provisions of Section 339 of the Act as that section stood prior to the amendment of May 26, 1941. The Secretary and his co-defendants have appealed. Part 1. The holding of the court below that the Secretary's speech invalidated the referendum is manifest error. Read as a whole and in the context of world events that constituted his principal theme, the penalties of which he spoke were more likely those in the form of ruinously low prices resulting from the excess supply, rather than the penalties prescribed in the Act. But under any interpretation, the speech cannot be given the effect of invalidating the referendum. There is no evidence that any voter put upon the Secretary's words the interpretation that impressed the court below, or was in any way misled. There is no showing that the speech influenced the outcome of the referendum. The record, in fact, does not show that any, and does not suggest a basis for even a guess as to how many, of the voting farmers dropped work to listen to Wheat Farmers and the Battle for Democracy at 11:30 in the morning of May 19th. Which was a busy hour and one of the busiest of seasons. If this discourse intended reference to this legislation at all, it was of course a public act whose terms are readily available, and the speech did not purport to be an exposition of its provisions. To hold that a speech by a cabinet officer which failed to meet judicial ideals of clarity, precision, and exhaustiveness may defeat a policy embodied in an act of Congress would invest communication between administrators and the people with perils heretofore unsuspected. Moreover, we should have to conclude that such an officer is able to do by accident what he has no power to do by design. Appellee's complaint, insofar as it is based on this speech, is frivolous, and the injunction, insofar as it rests on this ground, is unwarranted. Part 2. It is urged that under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, Congress does not possess the power it has in this instance sought to exercise. The question would merit little consideration since our decision in United States versus Darby, sustaining the federal power to regulate production of goods for commerce, except for the fact that this act extends federal regulation to production not intended in any part for commerce, but wholly for consumption on the farm. The Act includes a definition of market and its derivatives, so that as related to wheat, in addition to its conventional meaning, it also means to dispose of by feeding in any form to poultry or livestock, which, or the products of which, are sold, bartered, or exchanged, or to be so disposed of. Hence, Marketing quotas not only embrace all that may be sold without penalty, but also what may be consumed on the premises. Wheat produced on excess acreage is designated as available for marketing, as so defined, and the penalty is imposed thereon. Penalties do not depend on whether any part of the wheat, either within or without the quota, is sold or intended to be sold. The sum of this is that the federal government fixes a quota, including all that the farmer may harvest for sale or for his own farm needs, and declares that wheat produced on excess acreage may neither be disposed of nor used except upon payment of the penalty, or except it is stored as required by the Act, or delivered to the Secretary of Agriculture. Appellee says that this is a regulation of production and consumption of wheat. Such activities are, he urges, beyond the reach of congressional power under the Commerce Clause, since they are local in character and their effects upon interstate commerce are, at most, indirect. In answer, the government argues that the statute regulates neither production nor consumption, but only marketing, and in the alternative that if the Act does go beyond the regulation of marketing, it is sustainable as a necessary and proper implementation of the power of Congress over interstate commerce. The government's concern lest the Act be held to be a regulation of production or consumption rather than of marketing is attributable to a few dicta and decisions of this Court, which might be understood to lay it down that activities such as production, manufacturing, and mining are strictly local, and except in special circumstances, which are not present here, cannot be regulated under the commerce power because their effects upon interstate commerce are, as a matter of law, only indirect. Even today, when this power has been held to have great latitude, there is no decision of this Court that such activities may be regulated where no part of the product is intended for interstate commerce or intermingled with the subjects thereof. We believe that a review of the course of decision under the Commerce Clause will make plain, however, that questions of the power of Congress are not to be decided by reference to any formula which would give controlling force to nomenclatures such as production and indirect, and foreclose consideration of the actual effects of the activity in question upon interstate commerce. At the beginning, in Gibbons versus Ogden, Chief Justice Marshall described the federal commerce power with a breadth never yet exceeded. He made emphatic the embracing and penetrating nature of this power by warning that effective restraints on its exercise must proceed from political rather than from judicial processes. For nearly a century, however, decisions of this Court under the Commerce Clause dealt rarely with questions of what Congress might do in the exercise of its granted power under the clause, and almost entirely with the permissibility of state activity, which it was claimed discriminated against or burdened interstate commerce. During this period, there was perhaps little occasion for the affirmative exercise of the commerce power, and the influence of the clause on American life and law was a negative one, resulting almost wholly from its operation as a restraint upon the powers of the states. In discussion and decision, the point of reference, instead of being what was necessary and proper to the exercise by Congress of its granted power, was often some concept of sovereignty thought to be implicit in the status of statehood. Certain activities such as production, manufacturing, and mining were occasionally said to be within the province of state governments and beyond the power of Congress under the Commerce Clause. It was not until 1887, with the enactment of the Interstate Commerce Act, that the interstate commerce power began to exert positive influence in American law and life. This first important federal resort to the commerce power was followed in 1890 by the Sherman Antitrust Act, and thereafter, mainly after 1903, by many others. These statutes ushered in new phases of adjudication, which required the Court to approach the interpretation of the Commerce Clause in the light of an actual exercise by Congress of its power thereunder. When it first dealt with this new legislation, the Court adhered to its earlier pronouncements and allowed but little scope to the power of Congress. These earlier pronouncements also played an important part in several of the five cases in which this Court later held that acts of Congress under the Commerce Clause were in excess of its power. Even while important opinions in this line of restrictive authority were being written, however, other cases called forth broader interpretations of the Commerce Clause destined to supersede the earlier ones, and to bring about a return to the principles first enunciated by Chief Justice Marshall in Gibbons versus Ogden. Not long after the decision of United States versus Knight Company, Mr. Justice Holmes, in sustaining the exercise of national power over intrastate activity, stated for the court that commerce among the states is not a technical legal conception, but a practical one, drawn from the course of business. It was soon demonstrated that the effects of many kinds of intrastate activity upon interstate commerce were such as to make them a proper subject of federal regulation. In some cases, sustaining the exercise of federal power over intrastate matters, the term direct was used for the purpose of stating rather than of reaching a result. In others, it was treated as synonymous with substantial or material, and in others, it was not used at all. Of late, its use has been abandoned in cases dealing with questions of federal power under the Commerce Clause. In the Shreveport rate cases, the court held that railroad rates of an admittedly intrastate character and fixed by authority of the state might, nevertheless, be revised by the federal government because of the economic effects which they had upon interstate commerce. The opinion of Mr. Justice Hughes found federal intervention constitutionally authorized because of matters having such a close and substantial relation to interstate traffic that the control is essential or appropriate to the security of that traffic, to the efficiency of the interstate service, and to the maintenance of conditions under which interstate commerce may be conducted upon fair terms and without molestation or hindrance. The court's recognition of the relevance of the economic effects in the application of the Commerce Clause, exemplified by this statement, has made the mechanical application of legal formulas no longer feasible. Once an economic measure of the reach of the power granted to Congress in the Commerce Clause is accepted, questions of federal power cannot be decided simply by finding the activity in question to be production, nor can consideration of its economic effects be foreclosed by calling them indirect. The present Chief Justice has said, in summary of the present state of the law, "The commerce power is not confined in its exercise to the regulation of commerce among the states. It extends to those activities intrastate which so affect interstate commerce, or the exertion of the power in Congress over it, as to make regulation of them appropriate means to the attainment of a legitimate end, the effective execution of the granted power to regulate interstate commerce. The power of Congress over interstate commerce is plenary and complete in itself, may be exercised to its utmost extent, and acknowledges no limitations other than are prescribed in the Constitution. It follows that no form of state activity can constitutionally thwart the regulatory power granted by the Commerce Clause to Congress. Hence, the reach of that power extends to those intrastate activities which in a substantial way interfere with or obstruct the exercise of the granted power."